Scotch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the films Night Swim, Freud's Last Session, What If Season 2, Steamboat Willie and Plane Crazy, and The Creator. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Red Dwarf. Yes, I'm going to revisit that again. I do that every year. If you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Blue Sky or Mastodon, I'm at Kevin Carr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Let's hit the box office really quick. The news that has been reported is that Warner Brothers had a stellar weekend because it had three of the five films in the top five, where it's in fact three of the top four, because it had Wonka at the number one, Aquaman 2 at number two, and then The Color Purple at number four. I mean, Wonka's doing great. Wonka is doing fantastic, and as it should. It's a great little movie, and that's certainly becoming a moneymaker for Warner Brothers. Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom's not. Even though it's clocking in at about $20 million, like $18 million for the weekend, that is really low for, at least compared to the previous Aquaman film, which sort of, it opened middling, but it eked its way to like a billion-dollar movie. I don't see this happening here. And I haven't seen it, but I think the reason Aquaman 2 is going to struggle as it goes into January is because it's a lame duck movie. It's the end of the DC cinematic universe, and there's nothing to build off of because they're rebooting it anyway. So that's the danger of putting things in the pipeline. You know, when Marvel was putting stuff in the pipeline, it was great because they had just hit after hit after hit. But when you stop getting the hits, it becomes very expensive. And then The Color Purple, actually, that's a really good movie. It made news because on Christmas Day, it had such a huge box office. And it certainly is getting the money in there. Migration's in the top five, and it's doing okay for a movie like that, but it's not nearly at the level of stuff like Sing and the Minion films. And then Anyone But You, while it's not doing great, it's certainly going to be enough based on its budget. Another thing I want to talk about is really quickly, the Critics' Choice Awards are next Sunday, January 14th, 7 to 10 p.m. You can check to see whether the movies I've been talking about are on the list. Again, I get a vote in that, so we'll have to check that out. Barbie has 18 nominations, and Oppenheimer and Poor Things have 13. One of the things to just note, especially as we're rolling towards Oscar, is Barbie has so many, and this is not to take anything away from that movie, because it certainly is gobbling up all the major nominations like Best Picture, Best Director, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the reasons that Barbie has a higher number than something like Oppenheimer is just like three songs that are nominated. That's not to diminish anything that Barbie's accomplished. That's just explaining why there's such an almost uncanny gap between 13 and 18. Well, I mean, Oppenheimer didn't have like a bunch of pop songs associated with it. The next thing I want to talk about is a Steamboat Willie. I'll be talking about that throughout this episode because, as predicted, as soon as Steamboat Willie fell into public domain, there are people making horror movies of it. And here's the thing you got to understand, because I've seen people say, you shouldn't be allowed to do that. And I'm like, that's what the public domain means. Public domain means you own it. It's a public movie. Nobody can secure those rights and withhold those rights. There is no requirement to be good or ethical or in good taste or even make something of quality. And what I found really funny is on January 1st, you suddenly saw all these memes of Steamboat Willie. So there's all these pictures of people doing all this stuff with Steamboat Willie. Now we can do this. But what's funny is I don't recall a time where Disney was out there suing people for putting memes together. You could make these memes anytime in the past because it also falls under parody. All you're really getting is with the Steamboat Willie going in there is that any streaming service can now put the movie online and stream it, but also it just means that you have the right to do it, but you can now use the name Mickey Mouse. And I mean, it really only loosens the ability a little bit. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Connor, and with that talk about Steamboat Willie, let's roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is the very obvious, very predictable movie that's coming out that was announced on January 1st. It's already been shot. And that is Mickey's Mousetrap, which is in theaters in March.
There's blood all over the jungle gym.
Blood?
Yes. Put the phone down! Put the phone down, please!
I was like, dude, I've already stopped.
No, Gina, turn around, please, Gina!
I'll be right back.
Man, he's dead.
What?
Like, if he was in a horror movie, you'd never say, I'll be right back. Because then you don't.
This sounds awful. First of all, the trailer, as you hear, ends with a joke that comes from Scream. Already there was a movie that deconstructed horror films and makes this joke. And they're putting it in here like it's new. This looks awful. This looks exactly like what I would have predicted, or what I did predict, when somebody says, hey, Steamboat Willie's in the public domain. Let's make a movie about Mickey Mouse being a slasher killer. And you know, it's a lot like Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey, because Blood and Honey looked like it was a better movie than this thing looks like. This movie looks just shoddily put together. It doesn't even, the sound mix is even bad in the trailer. And you know, it's really bad. I mean, when you can't even get the trailer sounding proper, it looks terrible. But what you have to remember is, just because somebody can do something doesn't mean they should or they could. And I'm talking about it from an artistic standpoint. This is just a bad movie. This is just an attempt to cash in on notoriety. And that's not what makes horror, and that's not what makes art. It's sort of like The Human Centipede. That movie that was really popular, that series a couple years ago, about 15 years ago. The Human Centipede was this notorious concept that this director named Tom Six came up with. And all three movies are terrible. There's a bit in the first movie, because Dieter Laser, who plays the bad guy, he's actually quite good as an actor. But the rest of the movies are all awful. And if you notice, Tom Six hasn't done anything since. He had that one chance of doing The Human Centipede, and he had so much attention on him, but he was so vacuous of a talent that he went nowhere with it. And so Human Centipede has a certain, you know, notoriety to it, but you know, I mean, that's like what this stuff is. No one's going to remember. Nobody remembers who made that Winnie the Pooh movie, and I don't think anyone's gives it any sort of credit. So, I mean, Mickey's Mousetrap looks just absolutely freaking terrible. The next one I want to talk about is actually coming to legit theaters. It's a horror movie. It's called The First Omen, which opens in theaters on April 5th.
You don't have to be afraid. This child is his way.
Now, this is just a teaser, so you don't really get much of it, but I don't know how you say The First Omen. I mean, it's based on biblical prophecy. So is the devil trying to do this a couple times? I don't know. But there's that little bit at the end of the trailer you hear, and it sounds like it's backmasked. What that is, and here's what it says in real life, just so you know, I didn't broadcast anything bad on the radio.
Look at me, Damien. It's all for you.
That's a clip from the original Omen, the Damien, I'm doing this for you, before the nanny hangs herself at the birthday party. So it tries to tie back to the first movie. This could be awful, but it could be interesting. We'll see when we get a better trailer. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about the cartoon Steamboat Willie and Plain Crazy, and What If Season 2. Well, Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the reviews. And since we've been talking so much about Steamboat Willie, the iconic original, well, it was not actually the debut of Mickey Mouse. This is a weird thing. There's some, with any sort of history, nothing's ever as simple as the one-line debut of Mickey Mouse or first sound cartoon. Steamboat Willie was neither of those. I believe there were other cartoons that had synchronized sound, but it was one of the first. But the thing is, even the old black and white silent cartoons ended up getting re-released with a soundtrack to them. Because a lot of times with these things, you just have a piano player or music in the background that was performed live. And these cartoons, that's why there was really not a whole lot of dialogue in them. They could just have music and sound effects and that sort of thing, and it made it easy to present. But when they re-release them, they will add sound to it. So I believe the original debut of Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse was in a short called Plane Crazy, which also came out around that same time. I just don't think it got distribution. It was made first, but then Steamboat Willie was the first one that was released, and it had synchronized sound from the beginning. But let's take a look at these, and I want to just talk a little bit about them because they're making so much news, and in particular Steamboat Willie is. They're making so much news now because of the public domain. But let's go back and look at the actual content of the original films. These early Disney animated shorts introduce the world to Mickey and Minnie Mouse as they ride on a riverboat and build their own airplane. This is just the music, the soundtrack to it. There's no way to really cut a trailer because it's all just noises and music. But it's this whimsical cartoon. And what's funny about it is it's neat to watch these, and you can find them on the internet, especially now you can find Steamboat Willie probably anywhere. But I believe they're both on Disney Plus. You know, it is still iconic Disney films. But what's interesting about watching Steamboat Willie is watching it without all the weight that Mickey Mouse has behind him. Mickey Mouse now is an international ambassador of goodwill. But back then, he was just this mouse that rode a riverboat. And so there's not the mean-spiritedness. I think the big difference, if you go back to these Disney shorts, the mean-spiritedness that you get with some of the other characters, which I love. I mean, Tom and Jerry, I love that. And I love the sarcastic and at times a little bit more darker edge to those. Same thing with Looney Tunes. But the Disney shorts have generally always had a kinder, gentler touch. They've always been very much for the kiddies. Now, what's interesting about the animation is it is rudimentary. I mean, it's not as simple as it could be, and they'd been doing shorts. But apparently what had happened is IBWorks and Disney were doing things together, and they had Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, who was basically looked a lot like Mickey Mouse, only he was a shape of a rabbit. But that was originally the sort of the iconic image for Disney cartoons. And they decided to go in a different direction. They wanted a new look. And so they got Mickey Mouse. And that's kind of how they created him. And Mickey and Minnie both appeared at the same time. And Minnie because, you know, with her pantaloons and everything. But they're certainly not as nuanced as they are now. And they're not as clean cut as they are now. And what's really neat about watching like Steamboat Willie and Plane Crazy, because both of them have Mickey trying to do things and things not go wrong, and then he gets frustrated. And there's in particular a scene where Mickey just sort of goes, and he kind of flexes, he kind of hulks out for a moment. And that's just because the animators hadn't quite figured out how to convey emotion with a anthropomorphized animal like that. I mean, they eventually figure it out with Donald Duck, and Donald Duck becomes the poster child for frustration and rage. But it's real neat to go back. I remember back when I was reviewing DVDs, I got an old classic Disney animated DVD that Disney had done. And it was these old 1920s short films. And I really love the purity of them. The fact that they aren't bringing decades and decades of the studio with them. They're just doing these one-shot cute cartoons. So yeah, these are charming and beautifully made, and the early animation provides a window into the past. something you don't always get to see. I say seek these out. Watch some of these old black and white cartoons because, I mean, they're not fully fleshed out completely even, and a lot of them repeat the motion because that's easy to do. But it's a piece of history that a lot of people forget, and that people are sort of just stirring the chum right now for Steamboat Willie when they really got something great. I'm going to say that these cartoons rock.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about What If Season 2. More installments in this loosely connected yet clever stories of huge events that didn't happen in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but could.
I don't do sequels normally, but things have gotten a little twisted in the multiverse.
I've been looking for you for a long time. Just be careful. I don't think I can bear to narrate what might happen next.
The What If idea goes all the way back to the comic books, and not everybody knows this, but they did a first season a couple years ago. And the basic gist is there's this character called the Watcher, played by Jeffrey Wright, who I still can't figure out if he's a version of Kang the Conqueror or not. But he basically looks at the multiverse and he looks at the different things that could have happened. Like a great example is, what if Peggy Carter took the super serum instead of Steve Rogers and she became the super soldier? And then you have Captain Carter instead of Captain America, and instead of the American Shield, she's got the Union Jack on hers. And that's the gist of the What If series, but they do a lot of different things. And the first season was really interesting because it just gave you, what if so-and-so lost this battle? Or what if somebody decided not to join? Like, what if Tony Stark never joined the Avengers? You know, these kind of things. But they've evolved the series a little bit into the second season. And, I mean, the first episode debuted, I think, on December 22nd, and they did a new one each day. And so by the time you got to the end of the year, you have all 9 episodes. And rather than just having this hodgepodge of random what-ifs, they sort of time together. And in particular, Peggy Carter kind of becomes one of the focal points of this. And they're making this a little more sophisticated and connecting things together. I don't want to give much away, but it also introduces some characters. And the reason I love this, first of all, animation has always been a great source for watching comic book adaptations. The animated world is at times way better than the live action. Partly because the point is, if you have an episode of this, it's not great. You haven't spent $300 million on a film. And you don't have to restructure an entire universe. You can just adjust it. You know, I'm all for taking big swings because I think you end up with some great content, but you have to have it dialed back a bit. And that's really what makes this thing work, is it still has your favorite characters and it has a lot of the same voices or sound-alike performances in there. But, I mean, it's a lot of fun. I enjoyed it. I like this one almost better than some of the movies. I mean, this series proves the rule that the most innovative and creative options for storytelling and cinematic comic books is in the field of animation. What If Season 2 totally rocks?
It rocks.
Excellent!
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, we've got Night Swim and Freud's Last Session. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the films and talk about the new film, the one new film that's new this week, and that is Night Swim. First of all, if you aren't aware, if you're not paying attention to release schedules, it's kind of become a tradition over the last 20-some years that the first film coming out in January is some horror movie, usually a PG-13 horror movie. Blumhouse has sort of ruled this spot for years. And last year we had something like Megan, which was quite clever and fun and enjoyable. This year we get Night Swim, so there's an ups and downs. A family moves into a house with a pool that provides therapeutic help for the father, but something sinister is lurking in the water.
When we were fixing up the pool...
Stop!
They said it hadn't been used in 15 years. Maybe they weren't pool people. I used to be scared of pools.
Marco.
Why aren't you saying anything? My kids have seen things. And I'm worried something is happening to my husband.
I know we've had haunted houses, haunted mansions. We've had haunted boats and spaceships, a haunted pizza parlor with Five Nights at Freddy's, and Willy's Wonderland. I mean, the haunted pizza parlor is kind of more common than haunted mansions at this point. Why not have a haunted swimming pool? It's a ridiculous idea. It really is. It's stupid. But look, I can go for the ridiculous ideas. I am all for absurd ideas and swinging for the fences. I think you can get some really great stuff. And horror doesn't always have to make heavily pragmatic sense. So I like one that tries something different. And so I thought this was a cool idea. But the problem is, it's the execution. That's the real problem. The writing is poorly written. It has terrible characters. Basically, the characters and how they work, it follows such a formula. The formula of being these people show up, they see this bad stuff happening, so you have to go find an expert, and then the one person is trying to convince everybody else that it's bad. I mean, it just hits all those points in that predetermined script, and it's so clunkily put together. And what's so depressing about it is Kerry Condon plays the main character. She's the mother, and she is such a great actress. I mean, if you saw The Banshees of Inisherin last year, or 2 years ago, I guess, you saw how good she was. She is so good. And unfortunately, more people are going to see her in this movie, which is a pile of garbage. I mean, it's really bad. The idea is there. It's just brought to the surface very, very poorly. And then the other thing, and I've been raging about this for years, it's shot with that naturalistic lighting. There are literally scenes where people go into a room and not turn on a light at all. Or they come into a kitchen and all the windows in the back are blasting light inside and you can't tell anything that's going on in the kitchen. And when you have that kind of cinematography, which I know is trendy now, but it looks like crap. It looks like garbage. And you wonder why people aren't going to the theater as much as you want them to. It's because you can't see this crap. Because half the time, the theaters don't project it properly. And what's funny, this movie theater that I went to go see this, I'd seen another movie earlier in the week, which I'll talk about next week, and that one was projected great. That had the bulb was good, it was bright, and then I got into this one, and I couldn't see crap. I mean, it was like looking through a murky fish tank, and I couldn't discern what was going on. It was so, because I think it was a smaller theater, and they put the smaller films in there, and they don't change the bulb when they should, because if you don't know this, theater bulbs, a lot of theater projection bulbs get weaker over time. They don't burn out like a traditional light bulb does. They can, but they eventually fade to the point that they're not, and you can turn the brightness down so you can extend the life of the bulb, and that's what they're doing, and so you can't see anything. So it's an ugly-looking movie. It's not clever. It's not original. It's almost like the characters are improvising their lines because it doesn't feel like it's been thought through. It's real half-baked. So, I mean, the absurd premise fails to work because the writing is stilted and cliche and full of nonsensical character moments. I mean, this movie is just, this is exactly the kind of film that you expect when you say, hey, it's the first horror movie released in the year. Oh, and it's PG-13. I'm going to say Night Swim sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Freud's Last Session. This came out on December 22nd in limited release. I don't know where it is throughout the country. It didn't really get any traction for award season. It's not getting award nominations. So you're not hearing a whole lot about it. But let's talk about Freud's Last Session. At the end of his life, Dr. Sigmund Freud has an intimate conversation about life and religion with a young C.S. Lewis.
Forgive me, but why would you come here to see me if you disagree so passionately with my views?
To make you realize that you're wrong.
Well done.
You've insisted all your lives that the very concept of God is ludicrous.
Yes. Why someone of your supreme intellect would suddenly abandon truth and then embrace a ludicrous dream, an insidious lie.
Well, I wholeheartedly disagree.
Well, of course you disagree. You have to disagree. Otherwise, the entire structure of your childish faith would collapse into a rubble.
There's a lot of speculation as to whether Freud actually talked to C.S. Lewis. Apparently, he did have this conversation with this young academic. And it very well could have been C.S. Lewis, although it could have been somebody else. There's no proof that it was C.S. Lewis. But this movie takes it as if it was C.S. Lewis, because Lewis was a Christian and he believed in God, and he was also an academic and a scientist. And of course, Freud was an atheist. And that's really where their differences start. Because while they both respect each other for their positions, I mean, obviously Freud much older, there was still a mutual respect there. But it's one of those conversation movies. It's one of those what if, you know, you're talking about Marvel, what if? This is the what if it was C.S. Lewis who had this conversation with Freud. Maybe wouldn't it have been interesting to be a fly on the wall. And so it's not meant to be an actual true story this had happened. It's more a delivery vehicle of the two characters' philosophies. And you already take these characters who both of them wrote extensively on their thoughts on religion. And you can manufacture a conversation between the two of them. So I find that that's interesting. And that's just a technique that's used. I'm not going to slag on the movie saying, well, this is possibly not what happened. I don't think they mean it to be. This is the kind of conversation they would have. And when it comes down to it, the thing that makes this thing work, because it's essentially, I mean, there's a lot of other scenes where you break out and you have flashbacks or Freud's daughter's running around and trying to get him his medicine because he's has an ailment. But mostly it's just two guys in a room talking. And with a movie like that, you got to have good actors. And you do. I mean, Anthony Hopkins is fantastic. Does he do a great Freud? I don't know. I mean, Anthony Hopkins pretty much delivers Anthony Hopkins at this point. I don't think Anthony Hopkins, in his career, he doesn't have to do too much acting. He basically just shows up in his Anthony Hopkins. And they could be like, you're going to play Abraham Lincoln. And he comes off as Anthony Hopkins. And they could be like, you're going to play Steve Jobs. And he'd be Anthony Hopkins. You know what I mean? So that's how he's working in his life. And that's fine, because Anthony Hopkins is that kind of actor who could read the phone book and make it sound really interesting. And Matthew Good is sort of the pinch hitter. He's the secondary character playing C.S. Lewis. And Matthew Good is a fantastic actor and absolutely holds his own along with Anthony Hopkins. But he doesn't get as much attention because he doesn't have the career and the pedigree that Anthony Hopkins have. But they're both fantastic actors. And that's really the joy of this movie, is watching the two of them work off each other and not come to a conclusion. Either one's, the movie's not saying it's endorsing religion or endorsing atheism. It's basically presenting these two characters, these very strong opinionated characters, and what their thoughts were on it. So yeah, I mean, strong performances by Anthony Hopkins and Matthew Good raises this speculative conversation's interest. I'm going to say that Freud's Last Session kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I've got a review of The Creator and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Red Dwarf. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with some movie reviews. And I'm going to be catching up on some stuff. I do that a lot of times in January. There's always a ton of award films that come out. And there's some movies that also I didn't get a chance to see in their initial release due to screenings and schedules or the lack of screenings and my schedule. So I'm going to be doing that here because The Creator was nominated for a couple Critics' Choice Awards, and I decided I better go check it out because I missed it in September. They didn't screen it. And this is what's so frustrating about a movie like this, is it comes out, they don't try to screen it for me. And they're just, you know, like, can I see it? And then now, we're not going to screen this for you. Then it comes to award season, especially if it gets nominated for something, and they're like, oh, can you see my movie? And I'm like, where were you in September? This is me venting a little bit. That happened with the Iron Claw. I haven't seen the Iron Claw yet because I went on vacation right before Christmas. I took a week off. We went on a family cruise right in the middle of a tropical storm coming through the Caribbean. But anyways, I was on vacation, so I wasn't here. So I was trying to watch all of my stuff early. And I'm like, can I see the Iron Claw? And they're like, yeah, we really want you to see the Iron Claw, but not right now. And I'm like, come on, can I see the Iron Claw? I got to go. And they're like, we'll send it to you. And then like a week before I left, they're like, oh, here's the Iron Claw. Go watch it, watch it, watch it. And I'm like, dude, I'm sorry. Give it to me earlier and I can plan ahead, but don't, because studios do that. They're like, we want you to see our movie, but we want you to see our movie in 2 weeks when everyone else wants you to see their movie. The busiest week of the year, right before Christmas, everyone sends you their screener. And you're like, sorry, dude. But anyways, that's kind of what happened with the creator. But fortunately, now the creator's on streaming. So I figured I'd get a chance to watch it since I never did get to see it. After a devastating attack on a U.S. city, AI has been banned and a mercenary is tapped to infiltrate the machine's headquarters to discover their ultimate weapon against humanity.
10 years ago today, the artificial intelligence created to protect us detonated a nuclear warhead in Los Angeles. For as long as AI is a threat, we will never stop hunting them. This is a fight for our very existence.
We're the same. We can't go to heaven. Because you're not good, and I'm not a person.
Did you locate the weapon?
Yeah, it's a kid.
This is directed by Gareth Edwards. And if I were to sum up Gareth Edwards' filmmaking career in blockbuster movies, it would be with this line. Sometimes reshoots work, sometimes they don't. His three big movies are this, Rogue One, and Godzilla from 2014. And like Godzilla was, I mean, it was a big deal because it was a Godzilla movie, but it didn't have enough Godzilla in it. And it reeked of reshoots where they're trying to deal with characters and that sort of thing. And then he did Rogue One and everyone's like, Rogue One's the greatest Star Wars movie ever. Well, because at a certain point, Lucasfilm came in and was like, no, you actually have to tell this story. And they forced reshoots. And at that point, the reshoots worked because that movie had heavy studio oversight. It's Rogue One is a great example of sometimes studio oversight and micromanaging works. Well, then he does this movie, The Creator, and it just feels like it's been reworked multiple times. Like from act to act, it doesn't hold together. It doesn't feel like it's the same movie, the same motivations. John David Washington plays the lead character, and he's good to a degree, but I've yet to see a movie with him in it that he really knocks it out of the park, that he seems like, oh, he's the perfect guy. He's not his father. He's not Denzel. And in some movies, he's fine, but he's always somebody who's passable, who could be replaced by pretty much any other actor. And his whole character is, he's like, I wanted my girlfriend from the first scene that I wanted her. And that's his whole whiny explanation. That's his motivation to do anything, is like this whiny teenage character. There's no thought of humanity or the greater good or to do the right thing. It's just him and his whininess. And so I don't like that. It's also this movie came out at the wrong time because it came out in the wake of the SAG and the WGA strikes. Because at the time, it became very apparent during these strikes that AI was not going to be this easy little tool that's going to help everybody. It's at times people pointing out that it's plagiarism, that it uses other people's works to develop its database, that it is sometimes there just to try to replace human work as as a cost-cutting measure without thinking about the ethics of it. Basically, the idea in this movie is like, oh, but the AI, that's a new form of life form, and we need to respect it. And it was at the wrong time for that message, and I think that's part of the reason this movie flopped. But the other reason this movie flopped, it doesn't hold together because it explains like these things, these major plot points, and it explains with just a flippant line from somebody, and you're like, well, how can we even believe that that's real? And the main character's terrible. The main character has no focus, And the whole thing is that it's like, oh, well, it's this kid. And you still don't know whether this kid, which is this weapon, is that really a kid, or does it just look like a kid? It doesn't even play with it right. I mean, the poorly written cliches masquerade as cerebral science fiction, and it fails to cover up sloppy plot holes and obvious reshoots. This movie thinks it's smarter than it is, and it's really quite dumb. I'm going to have to say that the creator sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. It's become an annual tradition for me at the end of the year. I usually end up having to start sometime in September or at the very latest October. I like to rewatch TV series. And I was reading, and I read it on like a meme on Facebook, so I don't know if it has any sort of valid science behind it, but it feels like it's right. And it says people like to rewatch shows because it's a comfort thing. They know what's coming. There is a comfort food aspect to it. And I get into that every year. Every summer I rewatch The IT Crowd. I know. Gremlin, but it's a funny show. And every winter I rewatch, or fall and winter, I rewatch Red Dwarf. And I talk about it every year, it seems. So, you know, bear with me. I'm not going to review the whole series, but I have a couple thoughts on it in my most recent rewatch. But anyways, in Red Dwarf, a slob is stranded 3 million years into deep space, with only a robot, a humanoid cat, and the hologram of his dead bunkmate to keep him company.
I'm picking up life signs in Corridor Beta 12.
That's where we are.
And you should be able to see them. Get out of there!
Run! Not that way, the other way!
Move!
Wait. Could these life signs by any chance be yours?
Yes.
You know what the difference is between you and me?
I can't store hand luggage in my nostrils.
Like I said, for fans of the show who've heard me many times talk about Red Dwarf, I'm not going to deep dive into it. But I had some revelations that came to me when I was watching this again in 2023. The original run was like seasons 1 through 6. It happened in the late 80s, early 90s. And then they took a break, and then they did a 2-season run that was a little longer, but they did some cast changes that I wasn't a big fan of. Then they did a TV movie in 2009, and then they brought back the show again in 2012, and they did like 3 seasons. And then they did a final movie, which I think is the last one, because the people who run the show don't get along anymore. And they've said that they're going to do more Red Dwarf stuff, but they've been very cagey about what it's going to be, so it's probably going to be radio and comic books. But I found the way I like to watch it is when I finally get to the TV movie Back to Earth from 2009, I follow that up with the TV movie they did, The Promised Land, which they did last year, and I watch that before I watch seasons 10, 11, and 12, because I actually think 10, 11, 12 hit a really good stride. It gives a modern version of Red Dwarf, because you're dealing with older guys playing these roles, you know, because they were in their 20s back in the 80s, and now they're in their 50s. One of the things I've also learned is the guy who plays Cat, the character of Cat, who is basically, he's of a species that evolved from a house cat that was stuck in the hold of Red Dwarf while traveling for 3 million years. They don't know what to do with him when they first introduce him in the first season. He's just sort of like this outside joke. They finally kind of make him part of the crew by the time you get to the 3rd or 4th season. But by the time you get to the 10th season, he's actually my favorite character. Because, he gets some great lines, and he has some great monologues. And he's actually, I find, the funniest thing in the series in those last 3 seasons. And I really like it partly because the last 3 seasons, they really go big and examine some great topics. So check it out. It's on BritBox. I'm going to say Red Dwarf rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
And that's it for this week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Mean Girls and the Book of Clarence. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.